Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Plus $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Book 7, chapters 1 to 3 of 10 books on architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 books on architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 1. Floors. 1. First I shall begin with the concrete flooring, which is the most important of the polished finishings, observing that great pains and the utmost precaution must be taken to ensure its durability. If this concrete flooring is to be laid level with the ground, let the soil be tested to see whether it is everywhere solid, and if it is, level it off and upon it lay the broken stone with its bedding. But if the floor is either wholly or partly filling, it should be rammed down hard with great care. In case a wooden framework is used, however, we must see that no wall which does not reach up to the top of the house is constructed under the floor. Any wall which is there should preferably fall short, so as to leave the wooden planking above it an unsupported span. If a wall comes up solid, the unyielding nature of its solid structure must, when the joists begin to dry or to sag and settle, lead to cracks in the floor on the right and left along the line of the wall. 2. We must also be careful that no common oak gets in with the winter oak boards, for as soon as common oak boards get damp, they warp and cause cracks in floors. But if there is no winter oak and necessity drives, for lack of this it seems advisable to use common oak boards cut pretty thin, for the less thick they are, the more easily they can be held in place by being nailed on. Then, at the end of every joist, nail on two boards that they shall not be able to warp and stick up at the edges. As for turkey oak, or beech, or ash, none of them can last to a great age. When the wooden planking is finished, cover it with fern, if there is any, otherwise with straw, to protect the wood from being hurt by the lime. 3. Then, upon this, lay the bedding, composed of stones not smaller than can fill the hand. After the bedding is laid, mix the broken stone in the proportion, if it is new, of 3 parts to 1 of lime. If it is old material used again, 5 parts may answer to 2 in the mixture. Next, lay the mixture of broken stone, bring on your gangs, and beat it again and again with wooden beetles into a solid mass, and let it be not less than 3/4 of a foot in thickness when the beating is finished. On this lay the nucleus, consisting of pounded tile mixed with lime in the proportions of 3 parts to 1 and forming a layer not less than 6 digits thick. On top of the nucleus, the floor, whether made of cut slips or of cubes, should be well and truly laid by rule and level. 4. After it is laid and set at the proper inclination, let it be rubbed down so that, if it consists of cut slips, the lozenges, or triangles, or squares, or hexagons may not stick up at different levels, but be all jointed together on the same plane with one another. If it is laid in cubes, so that all the edges may be level, for the rubbing down will not be properly finished unless all edges are on the same level plane. The herringbone pattern, made of tibber burned brick, must also be carefully finished so as to be without gaps or ridges sticking up, but all flat and rubbed down to rule. When the rubbing down is completely finished by means of the smoothing and polishing processes, sift powdered marble on top and lay on a coating of lime and sand. 5. In the open air, specially adapted kinds of floor must be made, because their framework, swelling with dampness or shrinking from dryness, or sagging and settling, injures the floors by these changes. Besides, the frost and rime will not let them go unhurt. Hence, if necessity drives, we must proceed as follows in order to make them as free from defects as possible. After finishing the plank flooring, lay a second plank flooring over it at right angles, and nail it down so as to give double protection to the framework. Then mix with the new broken stone 1/3 the quantity of pounded tile, and let lime be added to the mixture in the mortar trough in the proportion of 2:5. 6. Having made the bedding, lay on this mixture of broken stone, and let it be not less than 1 foot thick when the beating is finished. Then, after laying the nucleus, as above described, construct the floor of large cubes, cut about 2 digits each way, and let it have an inclination of 2 digits for every 10 feet. If it is well put together and properly rubbed down, it will be free from all flaws. In order that the mortar in the joints may not suffer from frosts, drench it with oil dregs every year before winter begins. Thus treated, it will not let the hoar frost enter it. 7. If, however, it seems needful to use still greater care, lay 2-foot tiles, jointed together in a bed of mortar, over the broken stone, with little channels of 1 finger's breadth cut into the faces of all the joints. Connect these channels and fill them with a mixture of lime and oil, then rub the joints hard and make them compact. Thus, the lime sticking in the channels will harden and solidify into a mass, and so prevent the water or anything else from penetrating through the joints. After this layer is finished, spread the nucleus upon it and work it down by beating it with rods. Upon this lay the floor, at the inclination above described, either of large cubes or burnt brick in herringbone pattern, and floors thus constructed will not soon be spoiled. Chapter 2. The slaking of lime for stucco. 1. Leaving the subject of floors, we must next treat of stucco work. This will be all right if the best lime, taken in lumps, is slaked a good while before it is to be used, so that if any lump has not been burned long enough in the kiln, it will be forced to throw off its heat during the long course of slaking in the water, and will thus be thoroughly burned to the same consistency. When it is taken not thoroughly slaked but fresh, it has little crude bits concealed in it, and so, when applied, it blisters. When such bits complete the slaking after they are on the building, they break up and spoil the smooth polish of the stucco. 2. But when the proper attention has been paid to the slaking, and greater pains have thus been employed in the preparation for the work, take a hoe and apply it to the slaked lime in the mortar bed just as you would. If it sticks to the hoe in bits, the lime is not yet tempered, and when the iron is drawn out dry and clean, it will show that the lime is weak and thirsty. But when the lime is rich and properly slaked, it will stick to the tool like glue, proving that it is completely tempered. Then get the scaffolding ready, and proceed to construct the vaultings in the rooms, unless they are to be decorated with flat, coffered ceilings. Chapter 3. Vaultings and stucco work. 1. When vaulting is required, the procedure should be as follows. Set up the horizontal furring strips at intervals of not more than 2 feet apart, using preferably cypress, as fir is soon spoiled by decay and by age. Arrange these strips so as to form a curve, and make them fast to the joist of the floor above or to the roof, if it is there, by nailing them with many iron nails to ties fixed at intervals. These ties should be made of a kind of wood that neither decay nor time nor dampness can spoil, such as box, juniper, olive, oak, cypress, or any other similar wood except common oak, for this warps and causes cracks in work in which it is used. 2. Having arranged the furring strips, take cord made of Spanish broom and tie Greek reeds previously pounded flat to them in the required contour. Immediately above the vaulting, spread some mortar made of lime and sand to check any drops that may fall from the joist or from the roof. If a supply of Greek reed is not to be had, gather slender marsh reeds and make them up with silk cord into bundles all of the same thickness and adjusted to the proper length, provided that the bundles are not more than 2 feet long between any 2 knots. Then tie them with cord to the beams, as above described, and drive wooden pegs into them. Make all the other preparations as above described. 3. Having thus set the vaultings in their places and interwoven them, apply the rendering coat to their lower surface. Then lay on the sand mortar and afterwards polish it off with the powdered marble. After the vaultings have been polished, set the imposed mouldings directly beneath them. These obviously ought to be made extremely slender and delicate, for when they are large, their weight carries them down and they cannot support themselves. Gypsum should by no means be used in their composition, but powdered marble should be laid on uniformly, lest gypsum, by setting too quickly, should keep the work from drying uniformly. We must also beware of the ancients' scheme for vaultings, for in their mouldings the soffits overhang very heavily and are dangerous. 4. Some mouldings are flat, others in relief. In rooms where there has to be a fire or a good many lights, they should be flat so that they can be wiped off more easily. In summer apartments and in exedrae, where there is no smoke nor soot to hurt them, they should be made in relief. If it is always the case that stucco, in the pride of its dazzling white, gathers smoke not only from its own house but also from others. 5. Having finished the mouldings, apply a very rough rendering coat to the walls, and afterwards, when the rendering coat gets pretty dry, spread upon it the layers of sand mortar, exactly adjusted in length to rule and line, in height to the plummet, and at the angles to the square. The stucco will thus present a faultless appearance for paintings. When it gets pretty dry, spread on a second coat and then a third. The better the foundation of sand mortar that is laid on, the stronger and more durable in its solidity will be the stucco. 6. When not less than 3 coats of sand mortar, besides the rendering coat, have been laid on, then we must make the mixture for the layers of powdered marble, the mortar being so tempered that when mixed it does not stick to the trowel, but the iron comes out freely and clean from the mortar trough. After this powdered marble has been spread on and gets dry, lay on a medium second coat. When that has been applied and well rubbed down, spread on a finer coat. The walls, being thus rendered solid by 3 coats of sand mortar and as many of marble, will not possibly be liable to cracks or to any other defect. 7. And further, such walls, owing to the solid foundation given by thorough working with polishing instruments and the smoothness of it, due to the hard and dazzling white marble, will bring out in brilliant splendor the colors which are laid on at the same time with the polishing. These colors, when they are carefully laid on stucco still wet, do not fade, but are permanent. This is because the lime, having had its moisture burned out in the kiln, becomes porous and loses its strength, and its dryness makes it take up anything that may come in contact with it. On mixing with the seeds or elements that come from other substances, it forms a solid mass with them, and no matter what the constituent parts may then be, it must, obviously, on becoming dry, possess the qualities which are peculiar to its own nature. Hence, stucco that is properly made does not get rough as time goes on, nor lose its colors when it is wiped off, unless they have been laid on with little care and after it is dry. So, when the stucco on walls is made as described above, it will have strength and brilliancy and an excellence that will last to a great age. But when only 1 coat of sand mortar and 1 of fine marble had been spread on, its thin layer is easily cracked from want of strength, and from its lack of thickness it will not take on the brilliance due to polishing which it ought to have. 9. Just as a silver mirror that is formed of a thin plate reflects indistinctly and with a feeble light, while one that is substantially made can take on a very high polish and reflects a brilliant and distinct image when one looks therein, so it is with stucco. When the stuff of which it is formed is thin, it not only cracks but also soon fades. When, however, it has a solid foundation of sand mortar and of marble, thickly and compactly applied, it is not only brilliant after being subjected to repeated polishings, but also reflects from its surface a clear image of the beholder. 10. The Greek stucco worker not only employ these methods to make their works durable, but also construct a mortar trough, mix the lime and sand in it, bring on a gang of men, and beat stuff with wooden beetles, and do not use it until it has been thus vigorously worked. Hence, some cut slabs out of old walls and use them as panels, and the stucco of such panels and reflectors has projecting beveled edges all round it. 11. But if stucco has to be made on wattle and daub, there has to be cracks at the uprights and crossticks, because they must take in moisture when they are daubed with the mud, and cause cracks in the stucco when they dry and shrink. The following method will prevent this from happening. After the whole wall has been smeared with the mud, nail rows of reeds to it by means of fly nails, then spread on the mud a second time, and if the first rows have been nailed with the shaft transverse, nail on a second set with the shafts vertical, and then, as above described, spread on the sand mortar, the marble, and the whole mass of stucco. Thus, the double series of reeds with the shafts crossing on the walls will prevent any chipping or cracking from taking place. End of Book 7, Chapter 3. Book 7, Chapters 4 to 7 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 4. On stucco work in damp places, and on the decoration of dining rooms. 1. Having spoken of the method by which stucco work should be done in dry situations, I shall next explain how the polished finish is to be accomplished in places that are damp, in such a way that it can last without defects. First, in apartments which are level with the ground, apply a rendering coat of mortar, mixed with burnt brick instead of sand, to a height of about 3 feet above the floor, and then lay on the stucco so that those portions of it may not be injured by the dampness. But if a wall is in a state of dampness all over, construct a second thin wall a little way from it on the inside, at a distance suited to circumstances, and in the space between these two walls run a channel, at a lower level than that of the apartment, with vents to the open air. Similarly, when the wall is brought up to the top, leave air holes there, for if the moisture has no means of getting out by vents at the bottom and at the top, it will not fail to spread all over the new wall. This done, apply a rendering coat of mortar made with burnt brick to this wall, spread on the layer of stucco, and polish it. 2. But if there is no room enough for the construction of a wall, make channels with vents extending to the open air. Then lay 2-foot tiles resting on the margin of the channel on one side, and on the other side construct a foundation of pillars for them made of 8-inch bricks, on top of each of which the edges of 2 tiles may be supported, each pillar being not more than a hand's breadth distant from the wall. Then, above, set hooked tiles fastened to the wall from bottom to top, carefully covering the inner sides of them with pitch so that they will reject moisture. Both at the bottom and at the top above the vaulting they should have air holes. 3. Then whitewash them with lime and water so that they will not reject the rendering coat of burnt brick, for as they are dry from the loss of water burnt out in the kiln, they can neither take nor hold the rendering coat unless lime has been applied beneath it to stick the two substances together and make them unite. After spreading the rendering coat upon this, apply layers of burnt brick mortar instead of sand mortar, and finish up all the rest in the manner described above for stucco work. 4. The decoration of the polished surfaces of the walls ought to be treated with due regard to propriety, so as to be adapted to their situations and not out of keeping with differences in kind. In winter dining rooms, neither paintings on grand subjects nor delicacy of decoration in cornice work of the vaultings is a serviceable kind of design, because they are spoiled by the smoke from the fire and the constant soot from the lamps. In these rooms there should be panels above the dados, worked in black and polished, with yellow ochre or vermilion blocks interposed between them. After the vaulting has been treated in the flat style and polished, the Greek method of making floors for use in winter dining rooms may not be unworthy of one's notice, as being very inexpensive and yet serviceable. 5. An excavation is made below the level of the dining room to a depth of about 2 feet, and after the ground has been rammed down, the mass of broken stones or the pounded burnt brick spread on, at such an inclination that it can find vents in the drain. Next, having filled in with charcoal compactly trodden down, a mortar mixed of gravel, lime, and ashes is spread on to a depth of half a foot. The surface, having been made true to rule and level and smoothed off with whetstone, gives the look of a black pavement. Hence, at their dinner parties, whatever is poured out of the cups or spurted from the mouth no sooner falls than it dries up, and the servants who wait there do not catch cold from that kind of floor, although they may go barefoot. Chapter 5. The Decadence of Fresco Paintings. 1. For the other apartments, that is, those intended to be used in spring, autumn, and summer, as well as for atriums and peristyles, the ancients required realistic pictures of real things. A picture is, in fact, a representation of a thing which really exists or which can exist. For example, a man, a house, a ship, or anything else from whose definite and actual structure copies resembling it can be taken. Consequently, the ancients who introduced polished finishings began by representing different kinds of marble slabs in different positions, and then cornices and blocks of yellow ochre arranged in various ways. 2. Afterwards they made such progress as to represent the forms of buildings and of columns and projecting and overhanging pediments. In their open rooms, such as exedrae, on account of the size, they depicted the facades of scenes in the tragic, comic, or satiric style, and their walks, on account of their great length, they decorated with a variety of landscapes, copying the characteristics of definite spots. In these paintings there are harbors, promontories, seashores, rivers, fountains, straits, fanes, groves, mountains, flocks, shepherds. In some places there are also pictures designed in the grand style, with figures of the gods or detailed mythological episodes, or the battles at Troy, or the wanderings of Ulysses, with landscape backgrounds and other subjects reproduced on similar principles from real life. 3. But those subjects which were copied from actual realities are scorned in these days of bad taste. We now have fresco paintings of monstrosities rather than truthful representations of definite things. For instance, reeds are put in the place of columns, fluted appendages with curly leaves and volutes instead of pediments, candelabra supporting representations of shrines, and on top of their pediments numerous tender stalks and volutes growing up from the roots and having human figures senselessly seated upon them, sometimes stalks having only half-length figures, some with human heads, others with the heads of animals. 4. Such things do not exist, and cannot exist, and never have existed. Hence, it is the new taste that has caused bad judges of poor art to prevail over true artistic excellence. For how is it possible that a reed should really support a roof, or a candelabrum a pediment with its ornaments, or that such a slender, flexible thing as a stalk should support a figure perched upon it, or that roots and stalks should produce now flowers and now half-length figures? Yet when people see these frauds, they find no fault with them, but on the contrary are delighted and do not care whether any of them can exist or not. Their understanding is darkened by decadent critical principles, so that it is not capable of giving its approval authoritatively and on the principle of propriety to that which really can exist. The fact is that pictures which are unlike reality ought not to be approved, and even if they are technically fine, this is no reason why they should offhand be judged to be correct if their subject is lacking in the principles of reality carried out with no violations. 5. For instance, at Charles, Apaturius of Alabanda designed with skillful hand the scene of the little theatre which is there called the Ecclesiasterion, representing columns in it and statues, centaurs supporting the architraves, rotundas with round roofs on them, pediments with overhanging returns, and cornices ornamented with lions' heads, which are meant for nothing but the rainwater from the roofs. And then on top of it all he made an epicenium in which were painted rotundas, porticos, half-pediments, and all the different kinds of decoration employed in a roof. The effect of high relief in this scene was very attractive to all who beheld it, and they were ready to give their approval to the work. When Licymnius, the mathematician, came forward and said that the Alabandines were considered bright enough in all matters of politics, but that on account of one slight defect, the lack of the sense of propriety, they were believed to be unintelligent. In their gymnasium, the statues are all pleading causes, in their forum, throwing the discus, running or playing ball. This disregard of propriety in the interchange of statues appropriate to different places has brought the state as a whole into disrepute. Let us then beware lest this scene of Apaterius make Alabandines or Abderites of us. Which of you can have houses or columns or extensive pediments on top of this tiled roof? Such things are built above the floors, not above the tiled roofs. Therefore, if we give our approval to pictures of things which can have no reason for existence in actual fact, we shall be voluntarily associating ourselves with those communities which are believed to be unintelligent on account of just such defects. 7. Apaturius did not venture to make any answer, but removed the scena, altered it so that it conformed to reality, and gave satisfaction with it in its improved state. Would to God that Licymnius could come to life again and reform the present condition of folly and mistaken practices in fresco painting. However, it may not be out of place to explain why this false method prevails over the truth. The fact is that the artistic excellence which the ancients endeavored to attain by working hard and taking pains is now attempted by the use of colors and the brave show which they make. An expenditure by the employer prevents people from missing the artistic refinements that once lent authority to works. 8. For example, which of the ancients can be found to have used vermilion otherwise than sparingly, like a drug? But today whole walls are commonly covered with it everywhere. Then, too, there is malachite, green, purple, and Armenian blue. When those colors are laid on, they present a brilliant appearance to the eye, even although they are inartistically applied, and as they are costly, they are made exceptions in contracts to be furnished by the employer, not by the contractor. I have now sufficiently explained all that I could suggest for the avoidance of mistakes in stucco work. Next I shall speak of the components as they occur to me, and first I shall treat of marble, since I spoke of lime at the beginning. Chapter 6. Marble for use in stucco. Marble is not produced everywhere of the same kind. In some places the lumps are found to contain transparent grains like salt, and this kind, when crushed and ground, is extremely serviceable in stucco work. In places where this is not found, the broken bits of marble, or chips, as they are called, which marble workers throw down as they work, may be crushed and ground and used in stucco after being sifted. In still other places, for example on the borderline of Magnesia and Ephesus, there are places where it can be dug out all ready to use without the need of grinding or sifting, but as fine as any that is crushed and sifted by hand. Chapter 7. Natural colors. As for colors, some are natural products found in fixed places and dug up there, while others are artificial compounds of different substances treated and mixed in proper proportions so as to be equally serviceable. 1. We shall first set forth of natural colors that are dug up as such, like yellow ochre, which is termed ochra in Greek. This is found in many places, including Italy, but Attic, which was the best, is not now to be had, because in the times when there were slaves in the Athenian silver mines, they would dig galleries underground in order to find the silver. Whenever a vein of ochre was found there, they would follow it up like silver, and so the ancients had a fine supply of it to use in the polished finishings of their stucco work. 2. Red earths are found in abundance in many places, but the best in only a few, for instance at Sinope in Pontus, in Egypt, in the Balearic Islands of Spain, as well as in Lemnos, an island the enjoyment of whose revenues the Senate and Roman people granted to the Athenians. 3. peritoneum white gets its name from the place where it is dug up. The same is the case with the Melian white, because there is said to be a mine of it in Melos, one of the islands of the Cyclades. 4. Green chalk is found in numerous places, but the best is Smyrna. The Greeks call it Theodoteion, because this kind of chalk was first found on the estate of a person called Theodotus. 5. Orpiment, which is termed arsenikon in Greek, is dug up in Pontus. Sandarach in many places, but the best is mined in Pontus, close by the river Hypanis. End of Book 7, Chapter 7. Book 7, Chapters 8 to 14 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 8. Cinnabar and Quicksilver. 1. I shall now proceed to explain the nature of cinnabar. It is said that it was first found in the Silbian country belonging to Ephesus, and both it and its properties are certainly very strange. First, before getting to the vermilion itself by methods of treatment, they dig out what is called the clod, an ore like iron but rather of a reddish color and covered with a red dust. During the digging it sheds, under the blows of the tools, tier after tier of quicksilver, which is at once gathered up by the diggers. 2. When these clods have been collected, they are so full of moisture that they are thrown into an oven in the laboratory to dry, and the fumes that are sent up from them by the heat of the fire settle down on the floor of the oven and are found to be quicksilver. When the clods are taken out, the drops which remain are so small that they cannot be gathered up, but they are swept into a vessel of water, and there they run together and combine into one. 4 pints of it, when measured and weighed, will be found to be 100 pounds. 3. If the quicksilver is poured into a vessel, and a stone weighing 100 pounds is laid upon it, the stone swims on the surface, and cannot depress the liquid, nor break through, nor separate it. If we remove the 100-pound weight, and put on a scruple of gold, it will not swim, but will sink to the bottom of its own accord. Hence, it is undeniable that the gravity of a substance depends not on the amount of its weight, but on its nature. 4. Quicksilver is a useful thing for many purposes. For instance, neither silver nor copper can be gilded properly without it. And when gold has been woven into a garment, and the garment becomes worn out with age, that it is no longer respectable to use, the pieces of cloth are put into earthen pots and burned up over a fire. The ashes are then thrown into water and quicksilver added thereto. This attracts all the bits of gold and makes them combine with itself. The water is then poured off and the rest emptied into a cloth and squeezed into the hands, whereupon the quicksilver, being a liquid, escapes through the loose texture of the cloth, but the gold, which has been brought together by the squeezing, is found inside in a pure state. Chapter 9. Cinnabar continued. 1. I will now return to the preparation of vermilion. When the lumps of ore are dry, they are crushed into iron mortars, and repeatedly washed and heared until the impurities are gone, and the colors come. When the cinnabar has given up its quicksilver, and thus lost the natural virtues that it previously had, it becomes soft in quality, and its powers are feeble. 2. Hence, though it keeps its color perfectly when applied in the polished stucco finish of closed apartments, yet in open apartments, such as peristyles or exedrae or other places of the sort, where the bright rays of the sun and moon can penetrate, it is spoiled by contact with them, loses the strength of its color, and turns black. Among many others, the secretary Faberius, who wished to have his house on the Aventine finished in elegant style, applied vermilion to all the walls of the peristyle, but after 30 days they turned to an ugly and mottled color. He therefore made a contract to have other colors applied instead of vermilion. 3. But anybody who is more particular and who wants a polished finish of vermilion that will keep its proper color should, after the wall has been polished and is dry, apply with a brush pontic wax, melted over a fire and mixed with a little oil. Then after this he should bring the wax to a sweat by warming it and the wall at close quarters with charcoal enclosed in an iron vessel. And finally he should smooth it all off by rubbing it down with a wax candle in clean linen cloths, just as naked marble statues are treated. 4. This process is termed ganosis in Greek. The protecting coat of pontic wax prevents the light of the moon and the rays of the sun from licking up and drawing the color out of such polished finishing. The manufactories, which were once at the mines of the Ephesians, have now been transferred to Rome, because this kind of ore was later discovered in Spain. The cloths are brought from the mines there and treated in Rome by public contractors. These manufactories are between the temples of Flora and Quirinus. 5. Cinnabar is adulterated by mixing lime with it. Hence, one will have to proceed as follows if one wishes to prove that it is unadulterated. Take an iron plate, put the cinnabar upon it, and lay it on the fire until the plate gets red hot. When the glowing heat makes the color change and turn black, remove the plate from the fire, and if the cinnabar, when cooled, returns to its former color, it will be proved to be unadulterated. But if it keeps the black color, it will show that it has been adulterated. 6. I have now said all that I could think of about cinnabar. Malachite green is brought from Macedonia and is dug up in the neighborhood of copper mines. The names Armenian blue and India ink show in what places these substances are found. Chapter 10. Artificial colors. Black. 1. I shall now pass to those substances which by artificial treatment are made to change their composition and to take on the properties of colors, and first I shall treat of black, the use of which is indispensable in many works, in order that the fixed technical methods for the preparation of that compound may be known. 2. A place is built like a Laconicum and nicely finished in marble, smoothly polished. In front of it, a small furnace is constructed with vents into the Laconicum and with a stoke hole that can be very carefully closed to prevent the flames from escaping and being wasted. Resin is placed in this furnace. The force of the fire in burning it compels it to give out soot into the Laconicum through the vents, and the soot sticks to the walls and the curved vaulting. It is gathered from them, and some of it is mixed and worked with gum for use as writing ink, while the rest is mixed with size and used on walls by fresco painters. 3. But if these facilities are not at hand, we must meet the exigency as follows, so that the work may not be hindered by tedious delay. Burn shavings and splinters of pitch pine, and when they turn to charcoal, put them out, and pound them in a mortar with size. This will make a pretty black for fresco painting. 4. Again, if the lees of wine are dried and roasted in an oven, and then ground up with size and applied to a wall, the result will be a color even more delightful than ordinary black, and the better the wine of which it is made, the better imitation it will give, not only of the color of ordinary black, but even of that of India ink. Chapter 11. Blue. Burnt ochre. 1. Methods of making blue were first discovered in Alexandria, and afterwards Vestorius set up the making of it at Puzzuoli. The method of obtaining it from the substances of which it has been found to consist is strange enough. Sand and the flowers of nature are braided together so finely that the product is like meal, and copper is grated by means of coarse files over the mixture, like sawdust, to form a conglomerate. Then it is made into balls by rolling it in the hands and thus bound together for drying. The dry balls are put in an earthen jar and the jars in an oven. As soon as the copper and the sand grow hot and unite under the intensity of the fire, they mutually receive each other's sweat, relinquishing their peculiar qualities, and having lost their properties through the intensity of the fire, they are reduced to a blue color. 2. Burnt ochre, which is very serviceable in stucco work, is made as follows. A clod of good yellow ochre is heated to a glow on a fire. It is then quenched in vinegar, and the result is a purple color. Chapter 12. White lead, verdigris, and artificial sonderek. 1. It is now in place to describe the preparation of white lead and of verdigris, which with us is called eruca. In Rhodes they put shavings in jars, pour vinegar over them, and lay pieces of lead on the shavings. Then they cover the jars with lids to prevent evaporation. After a definite time, they open them and find that the pieces of lead have become white lead. In the same way, they put in plates of copper and make verdigris, which is called erica. 2. White lead, on being heated in an oven, changes its colors on the fire and becomes sandarach. This was discovered as the result of an accidental fire. It is much more serviceable than the natural sandarach dug up in mines. Chapter 13. Purple. 1. I shall now begin to speak of purple, which exceeds all the colors that have so far been mentioned both in costliness and the superiority of its delightful effect. It is obtained from a marine shellfish, from which is made the purple dye, which is as wonderful to the careful observer as anything else in nature, for it has not the same shade in all the places where it is found, but is naturally qualified by the course of the sun. 2. That which is found in Pontus and Gaul is black, because those countries are nearest to the north. As one passes on from north to west, it is found on a bluish shade. Due east and west, what is found is of a violet shade. That which is obtained in southern countries is naturally red in quality, and therefore this is found in the island of Rhodes and in other such countries that are nearest to the course of the sun. 3. After the shellfish have been gathered, they are broken up with iron tools, the blows of which drive out the purple fluid like a flood of tears, and then it is prepared by braying it in mortars. It is called ostrum, because it is taken from the shells of marine shellfish. On account of its saltness, it soon dries up, unless it has honey poured over it. Chapter 14. Substitutes for purple, yellow ochre, malachite green, and indigo. 1. Purple colors are also manufactured by dyeing chalk with madder root and with hysginum. Other colors are made from flowers. Thus, when fresco painters wish to imitate Attic yellow ochre, they put dried violets into a vessel of water and heat them over a fire. Then, when the mixture is ready, they pour it onto a linen cloth and squeeze it out with the hands, catching the water, which is now colored by the violets, in a mortar. Into this they pour chalk and bray it, obtaining the color of Attic yellow ochre. 2. They make a fine purple color by treating bilberry in the same way and mixing it with milk. Those who cannot use malachite green on account of its dearness dye blue with a plant called dyer's weed, and thus obtain a most vivid green. This is called dyer's malachite green. Again, for want of indigo, they dye Selinusian and Anularian chalk with woad, which the Greeks call isatis, and make an imitation of indigo. 3. In this book I have written down, so far as I could recall them, the methods and means of attaining durability in polished finishings, how pictures that are appropriate should be made, and also the natural qualities of all the colors. And so, having prescribed in 7 books the suitable principles which should govern the construction of all kinds of buildings, I shall treat in the next of water, showing how it may be found in places where it is wanting, by what method it may be conducted, and by what means its wholesomeness and fitness may be tested. End of Book 7. Book 8, Introduction and Chapters 1 and 2 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 8. Introduction. 1. Among the 7 sages, Thales of Miletus pronounced for water as the primordial element in all things, Heraclitus for fire, the priests of the Magi for water and fire, Euripides, a pupil of Anaxagoras, and called by the Athenians the philosopher of the stage, for air and earth. Earth, he held, was impregnated by the rains of heaven, and, thus conceiving, brought forth the young of mankind and all of the living creatures in the world. Whatever is sprung from her goes back to her again when the compelling force of time brings about a dissolution, and whatever is born of the air returns in the same way to the regions of the sky. Nothing suffers annihilation, but at dissolution there is a change, and things fall back to the essential element in which they were before. But Pythagoras and Patroclus, Epicharmus, and other physicists and philosophers have set forth that the primordial elements are four in number, air, fire, earth, and water, and that it is from their coherence to one another under the moulding power of nature that the qualities of things are produced according to different classes. 2. And, in fact, we see not only that all which comes to birth is produced by them, but also that nothing can be nourished without their influence, nor grow, nor be preserved. The body, for example, can have no life without the flow of the breath to and fro, that is, unless an abundance of air flows in, causing dilations and contractions in regular succession. Without the right proportion of heat, the body will lack vitality, will not be well set up, and will not properly digest strong food. Again, without the fruits of the earth to nourish the bodily frame, it will be enfeebled, and so lose its admixture of the earthy element. 3. Finally, without the influence of moisture, living creatures will be bloodless, and having the liquid element sucked out of them, will wither away. Accordingly, the divine intelligence has not made what is really indispensable for man either hard to get or costly, like pearls, gold, silver, and so forth, the lack of which neither our body nor our nature feels, but has spread abroad, ready to hand through all the world, the things without which the life of mortals cannot be maintained. Thus, to take examples, suppose there is a deficiency of breath in the body, the air to which is assigned the function of making up the deficiency performs that service. To supply heat, the mighty sun is ready, and the invention of fire makes life more secure. Then again, the fruits of the earth, satisfying our desires with a more than sufficient store of foodstuffs, support and maintain living beings with a regular nourishment. Finally, water, not merely supplying drink, but filling an infinite number of practical needs, does us services which make us grateful because it is gratis. 4. Hence, too, those who are clothed in the priesthoods of the Egyptian orders declare that all things depend upon the power of the liquid element. So, when the water pot is brought back to precinct and temple with water, in accordance with the holy rite, they throw themselves upon the ground and, raising their hands to heaven, thank the divine benevolence for its invention. Therefore, since it is held by physicists and philosophers and priests that all things depend upon the power of water, I have thought that, as in the former 7 books the rules for buildings have been set forth, in this I ought to write on the methods of finding water, on those special merits which are due to the qualities of localities, on the ways of conducting it, and how it may be tested in advance, for it is the chief requisite for life, for happiness, and for everyday use. Chapter 1. How to find water. 1. This will be easier if there are open springs of running water. But if there are no springs which gush forth, we must search for them underground and conduct them together. The following test should be applied. Before sunrise, lie down flat in the place where the search is to be made, and placing the chin on the earth and supporting it there, take a look out over the country. In this way, the sight will not range higher than it ought, the chin being immovable, but will range over a definitely limited height on the same level through the country. Then, dig in the places where vapors are seen curling and rising up in the air. This sign cannot show itself in a dry spot. 2. Searchers for water must also study the nature of different localities, for those in which it is found are well defined. In clay the supply is poor, meager, and at no great depth. It will not have the best taste. In fine gravel the supply is also poor, but will be found at a greater depth. It will be muddy and not sweet. In black earth, some slight drippings and drops are found that gather from the storms of winter and settle down in compact, hard places. They have the best taste. Among pebbles, the veins found are moderate and not to be depended upon. These, too, are extremely sweet. In coarse-grained gravel and carbuncular sand, the supply is surer and more lasting, and it has a good taste. In red tufa it is copious and good, if it does not run down through the fissures and escape. At the foot of mountains and in lava it is more plentiful and abundant, and here it is also colder and more wholesome. In flat countries the springs are salt, heavy-bodied, tepid, and ill-flavored, excepting those which run underground from mountains and burst forth in the middle of a plain, where, if protected by the shade of trees, their taste is equal to that of mountain springs. 3. In the kinds of soil described above, science will be found growing, such as slender rushes, wild willows, alders, Agnus castus trees, reeds, ivy, and other plants of the same sort, that cannot spring up of themselves without moisture. But they are also accustomed to grow in depressions which, being lower than the rest of the country, receive water from the rains in the surrounding fields during the winter, and keep it for a comparatively long time on account of their holding power. These must not be trusted, but the search must be made in districts and soils, yet not in depressions, where those signs are found growing not from seed, but springing up naturally of themselves. 4. If the indications mentioned appear in such places, the following test should be applied. Dig out a place not less than 3 feet square and 5 feet deep, and put into it about sunset a bronze or leaden bowl or basin, whichever is at hand. Smear the inside with oil, lay it upside down, and cover the top of the excavation with reeds or green moss, throwing earth upon them. Next day uncover it, and if there are drops and drippings in the vessel, the place will contain water. 5. Again, if a vessel made of unbaked clay be put in the hole and covered in the same way, it will be wet when uncovered and already beginning to go to pieces from dampness, if the place contains water. If a fleece of wool is placed in the excavation, and water can be wrung out of it on the following day, it will show that the place has a supply. Further, if a lamp be trimmed, filled with oil, lighted, and put in that place and covered up, and if on the next day it is not burnt out, but still contains some remains of oil and wick, and is itself found to be damp, it will indicate that the place contains water, for all heat attracts moisture. Again, if a fire is made in that place, and if the ground, when thoroughly warmed and burned, sends up a misty vapor from its surface, the place will contain water. 6. After applying these tests, and finding the signs described above, a well must next be sunk in the place, and if a spring of water is found, more wells must be dug thereabouts, and all conducted by means of subterranean channels into one place. The mountains and districts with a northern exposure are the best spots in which to search, for the reason that springs are sweeter, more wholesome, and more abundant when found there. Such places face away from the sun's course, and the trees are thick in them, and the mountains, being themselves full of woods, cast shadows of their own, preventing the rays of the sun from striking uninterruptedly upon the ground and drying up the moisture. 7. The valleys among the mountains receive the rains more abundantly, and on account of the thick woods the snow is kept in them longer by the shade of the trees and mountains. Afterwards, on melting, it filters through the fissures in the ground and thus reaches the very foot of the mountains, from which the gushing springs come belching out. But in flat countries, on the contrary, a good supply cannot be had, for however great it is, it cannot be wholesome, because as there is no shade in the way, the intense force of the sun draws up and carries off the moisture from the flat plains with its heat, and if any water shows itself there, the lightest and purest and the delicately wholesome part of it is summoned away by the air and dispersed to the skies, while the heaviest and the hard and unpleasant parts are left in springs that are in flat places. Chapter 2. Rainwater. 1. Rainwater has, therefore, more wholesome qualities, because it is drawn from the lightest and most delicately pure parts of all the springs, and then, after being filtered through the agitated air, it is liquefied by storms and so returns to the earth. And rainfall is not abundant in the plains, but rather on the mountains or close to mountains, for the reason that the vapor which is set in motion at sunrise in the morning leaves the earth, and drives the air before it through the heaven in whichever direction it inclines. Then, when once in motion, it has currents of air rushing after it on account of the void which it leaves behind. 2. This air, driving the vapor everywhere as it rushes along, produces gales and constantly increases currents by its mighty blasts. Wherever the winds carry the vapor which rolls in masses from springs, rivers, marshes, and the sea, it is brought together by the heat of the sun, drawn off and carried upward in the form of clouds. Then these clouds are supported by the current of air until they come to mountains, where they are broken up from the shock of the collision, and the gales turn into water on account of their own fullness and weight, and in that form are dispersed upon the earth. 3. That vapor, mists, and humidity come forth from the earth seems due to the reason that it contains burning heat, mighty currents of air, intense cold, and a great quantity of water. So, as soon as the earth, which has cooled off during the night, is struck by the rays of the rising sun, and the winds begin to blow while it is yet dark, mists begin to rise upward from damp places. That the air, when thoroughly heated by the sun, can make vapors rise, rolling up from the earth, may be seen by means of an example drawn from baths. 4. Of course, there can be no springs above the vaultings of hot bathrooms, but the atmosphere in such rooms, becoming well warmed by the hot air from the furnaces, seizes upon the water on the floors and takes it up to the curved vaultings and holds it up there, for the reason that hot vapor always pushes upwards. At first it does not let the moisture go, for the quantity is small, but as soon as it has collected a considerable amount, it cannot hold it up on account of the weight, but sprinkles it upon the heads of the bathers. In the same way, when the atmospheric air feels the heat of the sun, it draws the moisture from all about, causes it to rise, and gathers it into clouds. For the earth gives out moisture under the influence of heat, just as a man's heated body emits sweat. 5. The winds are witnesses to this fact. Those that are produced and come from the coolest directions, the north and northeast winds, blow in blasts that are rarefied by the great dryness in the atmosphere, but the south wind and the others that assail us from the direction of the sun's course are very damp, and always bring rain, because they reach us from the warm regions after being well heated there, and licking up and carrying off the moisture from the whole country, they pour it out on the regions in the north. 6. That this is the state of the case may be proved by the sources of rivers, the majority and the longest of which, as drawn and described in the geographies of the world, are found to rise in the north. First in India, the Ganges and Indus spring from the Caucasus. In Syria, the Tigris and Euphrates, in Pontus, in Asia, the Dnieper, Bug, and Don, in Colchis, the Phasis, in Gaul, the Rhone, in Celtica, the Rhine, on this side of the Alps, the Timavo and Po, in Italy, the Tiber, in Maurusia, which we call Mauritania, the Durus, rising in the Atlas range and running westerly to Lake Heptagonus, where it changes its name and is called Agger. Then from Lake Haptobolus it runs at the base of barren mountains, flowing southerly and emptying into the marsh called It surrounds Meroe, which is a kingdom in southern Ethiopia, and from the marsh grounds there, winding round by the rivers Astansoba and Astoboa, and a great many others, it passes through the mountains to the cataract, and from there it dashes down and passes to the north between Elephantis and Syene and the plains of Thebes into Egypt, where it is called the Nile. 7. That the source of the Nile is in Mauritania is known principally from the fact that there are other springs on the other side of the Atlas range flowing into the ocean to the west, and that ichneumons, crocodiles, and other animals and fishes of like nature are found there, although there are no hippopotamuses. 8. Therefore, since in descriptions of the world it appears that all rivers of any size flow from the north, and since in the plains of Africa, which are exposed to the course of the sun in the south, the moisture is deeply hidden, springs not common, and rivers rare, it follows that the sources of springs which lie to the north or northeast are much better, unless they hit upon a place which is full of sulfur, alum, or asphalt. In this case they are completely changed, and flow in springs which have had a bad smell and taste, whether the water is hot or cold. 9. The fact is, heat is not at all a property of water, but when a stream of cold water happens upon a hot place, it boils up and issues through the fissures and out of the ground in a state of heat. This cannot last very long, but in a short time the water becomes cold. If it were naturally hot, it would not cool off and lose its heat. Its taste, however, and its smell and color are not restored, because it has become saturated and compounded with these qualities on account of the rarity of its nature. End of Book 8, Chapter 2. Book 8, Chapter 3 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 3. Various Properties of Different Waters. 1. There are, however, some hot springs that supply water of the best taste, which is so delightful to drink that one does not think with regret of the Fountain of Muses or the Marcian Aqueduct. These hot springs are produced naturally in the following manner. When fire is kindled down beneath an alum or asphalt or sulphur, it makes the earth immediately over it very hot, and emits a glowing heat to the part still farther above it, so that if there are any springs of sweet water found in the upper strata, they begin to boil in their fissures when they are met by this heat, and so they run out with their taste unimpaired. 2. And there are some cold springs that have a bad smell and taste. They rise deep down in the lower strata, cross places which are on fire, and then are cooled by running a long distance through the earth, coming out above ground with their taste, smell, and color spoiled. As for instance, the river Albula on the road to Tivoli and the cold springs of Ardea, which have the same smell and are called sulphur springs, and others in similar places. Although they are cold, yet at first sight they seem to be hot for the reason that when they happen upon a burning spot deep down below, the liquid and the fire meet, and with a great noise at the collision they take in strong currents of air, and thus, swollen by a quantity of compressed wind, they come out at the springs in a constant state of ebullition. When such springs are not open but confined by rocks, the force of the air in them drives them up through the narrow fissures to the summits of hills. 3. Consequently, those who think that they have excavated sources of springs at the height of such hills find themselves mistaken when they open up their excavations. Suppose a bronze vase filled not to the very lips, but containing two-thirds of the quantity of water which forms its capacity, and with a cover placed upon it. When it is subjected to a very hot fire, the water must come thoroughly heated, and from the rarity of its nature it greatly expands by taking in the heat, so that it not only fills the vase, but raises its cover by means of the currents of air in it, and swells and runs over. But if you take the cover off, the expanding forces are released in the open air, and the water settles down again to its proper level. So it is with the sources of springs. As long as they are confined in narrow channels, the currents of air in the water rush up in bubbles to the top, but as soon as they are given a wider outlet, they lose the air on account of the rarity peculiar to water, and so settle down and resume their proper level. 4. Every hot spring has healing properties because it has been boiled with foreign substances and thus acquires a new useful quality. For example, sulphur springs cure pains in the sinews by warming up and burning out the corrupt humors of the body by their heat. Aluminous springs, used in the treatment of limbs when enfeebled by paralysis or the stroke of any such malady, introduce warmth through the open pores, counteracting the chill by the opposite effect of their heat, and thus equably restoring the limbs to their former condition. Asphaltic springs, taken as purges, cure internal maladies. 5. There is also a kind of cold water containing natron, found, for instance, at Penn in the Vestine country, at Kutilai and at other similar places. It is taken as a purge, and its passing through the bowels reduces scrofulous tumors. Copious springs are found where there are mines of gold, silver, iron, copper, lead, and the like, but they are very harmful, for they contain, like hot springs, sulfur, alum, asphalt, and when it passes into the body in the form of drink, and spreading through the veins, reaches the sinews and joints, it expands and hardens them. Hence the sinews, swelling with this expansion, are contracted in length and so give men the cramp or the gout, for the reason that their veins are saturated with very hard, dense, and cold substances. 6. There is also a sort of water, which, since it contains that are not very perfectly clear, and it floats like a flower on the surface in color like purple glass. This may be seen particularly in Athens, where there are aqueducts from places and springs of that sort leading to the city and the port of Piraeus, from which nobody drinks, for the reason mentioned. But they use them for bathing and so forth, and drink from wells, thus avoiding their unwholesomeness. At Schützen it cannot be avoided, because no other kind of water at all is found, except what the Cibdeli furnish, and so in that city all or most of the people have diseases of the feet. At the city of Tarsus in Cilicia is a river named Cydnus, in which gouty people soak their legs and find relief from pain. 7. There are also many other kinds of water which have peculiar properties. For example, the river Himera in Sicily, which after leaving its source is divided into two branches. One flows in the direction of Etruria and has an exceedingly sweet taste on account of a sweet juice in the soil through which it runs. The other runs through a country where there are salt pits, and so it has a salt taste. At Paraetonium and on the road to Ammon and at Cassius in Egypt, there are marshy lakes which are so salt that they have a crust of salt on the surface. In many other places there are springs and rivers and lakes which are necessarily rendered salt because they run through salt pits. 8. Others flow through such greasy veins of soil that they are overspread with oil when they burst out as springs. For example, at Soli, a town in Cilicia, the river named Liparis, in which swimmers or bathers get anointed merely by the water. Likewise, there is a lake in Ethiopia which anoints people who swim in it, and one in India which emits a great quantity of oil when the sky is clear. At Carthage is a spring that has oil swimming on its surface and smelling like sawdust from citrus wood, with which oil sheep are anointed. In Zacynthus and about Dyrrachium and Apollonia are springs which discharge a great quantity of pitch with their water. In Babylon, a lake of very great extent, called Lake Asphaltitis, has liquid asphalt swimming on its surface, with which asphalt and with burnt brick Semiramis built the walls surrounding Babylon. At Jaffa in Syria and among the nomads in Arabia are lakes of enormous size that yield very large masses of asphalt, which are carried off by the inhabitants thereabouts. 9. There is nothing marvelous in this, for quarries of hard asphalt are numerous there. So, when a quantity of water bursts its way through the asphaltic soil, it carries asphalt out with it, and after passing out of the ground, the water is separated and so rejects the asphalt from itself. Again, in Cappadocia, on the road from Massaca to Tiana, there is an extensive lake into which, if a part of a reed or of some other thing be plunged and withdraw the next day, it will be found that the part thus withdrawn has turned into stone, while the part which remained above water retained its original nature. 10. In the same way, at Hierapolis in Phrygia, there is a multitude of boiling hot springs from which water is let into ditches surrounding gardens and vineyards, and this water becomes an incrustation of stone at the end of a year. Hence, every year they construct banks of earth to the right and left, let in the water, and thus out of these incrustations make walls for their fields. This seems due to natural causes, since there is a juice having a coagulating potency like rennet underground in those spots and in that country. When this potency appears above ground mingled with spring water, the mixture cannot but be hardened by the heat of the sun and air, as appears in salt pits. 11. There are also springs which issue exceedingly bitter owing to a bitter juice in the soil, such as the river Hypanis in Pontus. For about 40 miles from its source its taste is very sweet, then it reaches a point about 160 miles from its mouth, where it is joined by a very small brook. This runs into it, and at once makes the vast river bitter, for the reason that the water of the brook becomes bitter by flowing through the kind of soil and the veins in which there are sandaric mines. 12. These waters are given their different flavors by the properties of the soil, as is also seen in the case of fruits. If the roots of trees, vines, or other plants did not produce their fruits by drawing juices from soil of different properties, the flowers of all would be of the same kind in all places and districts. But we find in the island of Lesbos the protropum wine, in Maionia the catasacomanites, in Lydia the Timoleon, in Sicily the Marmontine, in Campania the Falernian, between Terracina and Fondi the Caecubian, and wines of countless varieties and qualities produced in many other places. This could not be the case, were it not that the juice of the soil, introduced with its proper flavors into the roots, feeds the stem, and mounting along it to the top, imparts a flavor to the fruit which is peculiar to its situation and kind. 13. If soils were not different and unlike in their kinds of juices, Syria and Arabia would not be the only places in which the reeds, rushes, and all the plants are aromatic, and in which there are trees bearing frankincense or yielding pepperberries and lumps of myrrh, nor would, as a photida, be found only in the stalks growing in Cyrene, but everything would be of the same sort, and produced in the soil of all countries. It is the inclination of the firmament and the force of the sun as it draws nearer or recedes in its course that makes these diversities such as we find them in different countries and places, through the nature of the soil and its juices. And not only in the case of the things mentioned, but also in that of sheep and cattle. These diversities would not exist if the different properties of the soils and the juices were not qualified by the power of the sun. 14. For instance, there are in Boeotia the rivers Cephisus and Melas, in Lucania the Crathis, in Troy the Xanthus, and certain springs in the country of the Clazomenians, the Erythraeans, and the Laodiceans. When sheep are ready for breeding at the proper season of the year, they are driven every day during the season to those rivers to drink, and the result is that, however white they may be, they beget in some places whitey-brown lambs, in other places grey, and in others black as a raven. Thus, the peculiar character of the liquid entering their body produces in each case the quality with which it is imbued. Hence, it is said that the people of Ilium gave the river Xanthus its name, because reddish cattle and whitey-brown sheep are found in the plains of Troy near that river. 15. Deadly kinds of water are also found, which run through soil containing a nauseous juice and take in its poisonous quality. For instance, there is said to have been a spring at Terracina called the Spring of Neptune, which caused the death of those who thoughtlessly drank from it. In consequence, it is said that the ancients stopped it up. At Crobs, in Thrace, there is a lake which causes the death not only of those who drink of it, but also of those who bathe in it. In Thessaly, there is a gushing fount of which sheep never taste, nor does any sort of creature draw near to it, and close by this fount there is a tree with crimson flowers. 16. In Macedonia, at the place where Euripides is buried, two streams approach from the right and left of his tomb and unite. By one of these, travelers are in the habit of lying down and taking luncheon, because its water is good. But nobody goes near the stream on the other side of the tomb, because its water is said to be death-dealing. In Arcadia there is a tract of land called Nonacris, which has extremely cold water trickling from a rock in the mountains. This water is called Water of the Styx, and no vessel, whether of silver, bronze, or iron, can stand it without lying to pieces and breaking up. Nothing but a mule's hoof can keep it together and hold it, and tradition says that it was thus conveyed by Antipater through his son Iolas into the province where Alexander was staying, and that the king was killed by him with this water. 17. Among the Alps in the kingdom of Cottius there is a water those who taste of which immediately fall lifeless. In the Faliscan country on the Via Campana in the Campus Cornutus is a grove in which rises a spring, and there the bones of birds and of lizards and other reptiles are seen lying. Some springs are acid, as at Lyncestus, and in Italy in the Velian country, at Tyana in Campania, and in many other places. These, when used as drinks, have the power of breaking up stones in the bladder, which form in the human body. 18. This seems to be due to natural causes, as there is a sharp and acid juice contained in the soil there, which imparts a sharpness to these springs as they issue from it. And so, on entering the body, they disperse of all the deposits and concretions due to the use of other waters which they find in the body. Why such things are broken up by acid waters we can see from the following experiments. If an egg is left for some time in vinegar, its shell will soften and dissolve. Again, if a piece of lead, which is very flexible and heavy, is put in a vase and vinegar poured over it, and the vase covered and sealed up, the lead will be dissolved and turn into white lead. 19. On the same principle, copper, which is naturally more solid, will disperse and turn into verdigris if similarly treated. So also a pearl. Even rocks of lava, which neither iron nor fire alone can dissolve, split into pieces and dissolve when heated with fire and then sprinkled with vinegar. Hence, since we see these things taking place before our very eyes, we can infer that on the same principle even patients with a stone may, in the nature of things, be cured in like manner by means of acid waters, on account of the sharpness of the potion. 20. Then there are springs in which wine seems to be mingled, like the one in Paphlagonia, the water which intoxicates those who drink of the spring alone without wine. The Aquians in Italy and the tribe of the Meduli in the Alps have a kind of water which causes swellings in the throats of those who drink it. 21. In Arcadia is the well-known town of Cleta, in whose territory is a cave with running water which makes people who drink of it abstemious. At this spring there is an epigram in Greek verses inscribed on stone to the effect that the water is unsuitable for bathing and also injurious to vines, because it was at this spring that Melampus cleansed the daughters of Proteus of their madness by sacrificial rites, and restored those maidens to their former sound state of mind. The inscription runs as written below: Swain, if by noontide thirst thou art oppressed, when with thy flocks to Cleta's bounds thou'st heed, take from this fount a draught and grant a rest to all thy goats, the water nymphs beside. But bath not in't when full of drunken cheer, lest the mere vapour may bring thee to bane. Shun my vine-hating spring, Melampus, here, from madness once watched Proteus' daughters sane, and although offscoring here did hide, when they from Argus came to rugged Arcadia. 22. In the island of Zea is a spring of which those who thoughtlessly drink lose their understanding, and an epigram is cut there to the effect that a draught from the spring is delightful, but that he who drinks will come dull as a stone. These are the verses: This stone sweet streams of cooling drink doth drip, but stone his wits become who doth it sip. 23. At Susa, the capital of the Persian kingdom, there is a little spring, those who drink of which lose their teeth. An epigram is written there, the significance of which is to this effect, that the water is excellent for bathing, but that taking as drink it knocks out the teeth by the roots. The verses of this epigram are, in Greek, as follows: Stranger, you see the waters of a spring, in which 'tis safe for men their hands to lave, but if the weedy basin entering, you drink of its unpalatable wave, your grinders tumble out that selfsame day from jaws that orphaned sockets will display. 24. There are also in some places springs which have the peculiarity of giving fine singing voices to the natives, as at Tarsus in Magnesia and in other countries of that kind. Then there is Zama, an African city, which King Juba fortified by enclosing it with a double wall, and he established his royal residence there. 20 miles from it is the walled town of Ismuk, the lands belonging to which are marked off by a marvellous kind of boundary. For although Africa was the mother and nurse of wild animals, particularly serpents, yet not one is ever born in the lands of that town, and if ever one is imported and put there, it dies at once. And not only this, but if soil is taken from this spot to another place, the same is true there. It is said that this kind of soil is also found in the Balearic Islands. The above-mentioned soil has a still more wonderful property, of which I have learned in the following way. 25. Caius Julius, Massinissa's son, who owned all the lands about that town, served with Caesar the father. He was once my guest. Hence, in our daily intercourse, we naturally talked of literary subjects. During a conversation between us on the efficacy of water and its qualities, he stated that there were springs in that country of a kind which caused people born there to have fine singing voices, and that consequently they always sent abroad and bought handsome lads and ripe girls and mated them, so that their progeny might have not only fine voices but also beautiful forms. 26. This great variety in different things is a distribution due to nature, for even the human body, which consists in part of the earthy, contains many kinds of juices, such as blood, milk, sweat, urine, and tears. If all this variation of flavors is found in a small portion of the earthy, we should not be surprised to find in the great earth itself countless varieties of juices, through the veins in which the water runs, and becomes saturated with them before reaching the outlets of springs. In this way, different varieties of springs of peculiar kinds are produced, on account of diversity of situation, characteristics of country, and dissimilar properties of soils. 27. Some of these things I have seen for myself, others I have found written in Greek books, the authorities for these writings being Theophrastus, Timaeus, Posidonius, Hegesias, Herodotus, Aristides, and Metrodorus. These men, with much attention and endless pains, showed by their writings that the peculiarities of sites, the properties of waters, and the characteristics of countries are conditioned by the inclination of the heaven. Following their investigations, I have set down in this book which I thought sufficient about different kinds of water to make it easier by means of these directions for people to pick out springs from which they can conduct the water in aqueducts for the use of cities and towns. 28. For it is obvious that nothing in the world is so necessary for use as water, seeing that any living creature can, if deprived of grain or fruit or meat or fish or any one of them, support life by using other foodstuffs. But without water, no animal nor any proper food can be produced, kept in good condition, or prepared. Consequently, we must take great care and pains in searching for springs and selecting them, keeping in view the health of mankind. End of Book 8, Chapter 3.
What is Dax, are you?
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker on all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all, so we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge, trucks up 3.9%.
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.